Kirk and Kurtz, number 58. Barney, the friendly dinosaur.
We're eating up airtime. This is costing us minutes.
No, this is fine. We're good.
I'm Kirk Vaisola. I'm the founder and creative director of Mind the Font, and I'm here with my good friend
Andy Kurtz, founder and creative director of Buttermilk Creative.
And this is the Kirk and Kurtz Design Podcast. All right, so here's something really cool, man. Like I started following this gentleman, and I ran across him on LinkedIn, Mr. Barney Abramson, and I just admired this guy's work. We've had some great like text messaging through LinkedIn. I really appreciate him, and I'm gonna let him tell us more about himself. But really, really admire this dude so much, and I just wanted to welcome to the show. So Barney, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I know we've been trying to connect for a while, so I'm just happy that we were able to schedule it and make it happen. So very happy to be here.
Hey, doing man. Well. Thank
the
you,
right? Planets aligned.
Yes, Andy and I are super busy. Lots of irons in the fire, so no, I'm kidding. Just shit sometimes doesn't work out until it needs to work out, and today it needed to work out, so thank you so much for coming.
Absolutely,
on.
Thank you.
For those of you not familiar with Barney's work, he is a super eclectic and talented person. I almost want to say that design isn't even really his forte, so to speak. Like, he's really good about every aspect of design and understanding.
Everything.
Yeah, and it's cool. And the one thing, I mean, I just want to touch on this, but like anytime I go to someone that says, "Oh, I'm a designer," I'm like, "Okay, well let's see what this guy's doing, or let's see what this person's doing." And I went on his site. I'm like, "Oh, this shit's nice. It's clean. It's good. It's like, okay, he knows what's up. He knows what he's doing." Mm-hmm, one of the best things that always catches my eye is people who do their own illustration artwork. Always catches my eye, man. And like the bus wrap illustration that's done, it's just like, oh, so good. But
proud of that one.
But aside from all that, the question that Andy and I ask, unlike the villain story, is the origin story of the superhero of Barney. And Mr. Yes. Abramson, I would love to hear this.
Absolutely. Again, I'm very happy to be here today with you both. My origin story really started in an island in the Caribbean. I was born in the Dominican Republic, and I remember that while like the kids were outside riding bikes, flying kites, playing baseball, and kids do play baseball in the Dominican Republic, so the stereotype is true. I was always in my room drawing, and I'd rather do that than anything else. And it wasn't until one day my dad gave my brother and I a challenge to like draw something. My dad was also very artistic too. So he's like, you know, why don't you guys draw like a human figure? And I went ahead and I sketched mine. You know, I'm like doing like the t-shirt and the collar with the buttons and the belt with the lines on it, you know, and then my brother's over there. And by the way, I love my brother. He's my big brother, my superhero growing up. My brother, he draws a little stick figure. And I'm like, you know, try it again. You could probably do better, right? So he does it again. And it's again, it's the same like little sticks with the head and everything. And that's like the moment that I realized, like, okay, wait a minute. I see the world different. I see the...
And your brother sucks at drawing.
And absolutely, he still does. He's going to hate me, but he does suck at drawing.
Amazing at crypto, but he's terrible at drawing.
Totally. So to me, that was like the moment that I realized, like, you know, when you're young and you're a kid, you always want to have like one thing that you do really well so you can, you know, show off with your friends or whatever. You always want to have like that one thing. And I felt like being artistic or art was the one thing that made me different. So I obviously carried that throughout my entire career. My parents, I was lucky enough to have parents who kind of really invested in me when it came to my art. They were always either putting me in a class or buying me equipment that I needed to do art, right? In high school, same thing. I think I continued that passion. I remember always being or gravitating towards, you know, the artistic crew and theater and things like that. I remember taking every art class available. And it wasn't until I went to college that I took a bit of a left turn and I decided to do something different. My dad was kind of like a local celebrity in my town. I mean, it was a small town, like very tiny. But he was kind of like a local celebrity. He had his own like public TV show. And I used to be like his producer, his cameraman, his stage setup guy, his lighting guy. Wow. So when I went to college, I'm like, well, I'll just be in video production. And that way I can make money, right? Mm-hmm. I thought back then MTV was so popular. I'm like, one day I'll work for MTV, right? Yeah. Making videos or just whatever, right? And I really thought that it was a way for me to make money also. Not, I didn't think art was a way that I could make a profit, right? But I college is tough for me coming from I grew up in an immigrant town, so I had never really been outside of that environment where I was very protected. And then I went to like an all-white environment, and I was like, wow. So that plus, you know, not really liking video production. My grades were really bad. I remember having a GPA of 1.7 and being on probation. So I'm like, well, what can I do to like fix this? Like I have to fix this. And I thought, oh, I can go back to art. You know, I can take an art class, get an A. That'll help my GPA. So I did. I just literally took every art class available, from sculpting to graphic design, paintings, calligraphy. I took it all. And then, like, my junior year, I remember my advisor telling me, Barney, why don't you just become a graphic designer? It's like, that's, you're doing that already. You love art. And I was working at the time at, like, the computer lab. I was helping designers. And I was, like, the guy uploading and downloading Photoshop to the computers. Right. So it was like a perfect marriage between that and then art. And I decided to be a graphic designer. And ever since then, that's all I wanted to do.
Wow.
That's great, man. You know, it's
that's so cool.
Yeah. And it helps so much that your father was already doing art stuff. I mean, that is truly a blessing. I mean, I hate using that word because it's just, it's cliche, but it's really you're really fortunate to have. Right, you're really fortunate to have an artist, and aside from the design aspect and art aspect, it's like you have to also have passion for it too. You know, I think you do, and it's not even something. It's not even something that is teachable. It just feels like almost
it's innate. Inherited. Yeah, that's like, right.
Right, it's. It's so hard to describe it to people. Like, oh, you know, when I'm sitting there obsessing over fonts, and I'm telling my wife, and she's
doodling,
looks...
doodling in a meeting,
right?
You know, like instead of taking notes away in a meeting, you know,
you're right?
Just, you can't help it. This is how you think.
It just comes out. It just comes out. And I think one of the best things you mentioned that really relates to my struggle too is the whole idea of the low GPA, and then realizing like, this isn't what I do. It's not what I love. I was actually pre-med. And the fucked up thing is I really liked... Yeah. Yeah. Imagine. I really, really, really liked doing math. And I love science. And I love that whole idea behind it. I love the objectivity of it. So when I first heard about design, I was like, what the fuck? This is so subjective. Like, there's no answer. There is no answer. But that's not it. There are myriad answers. That's what it is. And that's the hard part about it. And it took me a while to actually understand that concept and embrace it. But you already knew, like, damn, this is what I need to be doing. I need to get back in art and bring up my GPA.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. I feel like,
you know, Barney's...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, your journey to designer, the art and the craft was always there through drawing and just the, like Kirk was saying, like the passion, it's just, you didn't have like a bucket to put
absolutely.
It in until, you know, design sort of formed itself. And so, yeah, like, I mean, I think that some of the most successful designers are the ones that didn't start from a technical standpoint. They started from a craft, from a passion standpoint, because you can learn the programs, you can learn the apps, you can learn all of those things. It's that passion, that discovery, the curiosity that a creative person has that you've always had. And that's really how you meander to that.
Absolutely.
Path.
I feel like it was always, again, from a very young age, I knew that that was like that thing that, you know, if I had a Batman belt, that'd be that one tool that I knew was going to get me out of trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
And when, you know, when I struggled in school, it really was a thing that really helped me kind of get through that tough moment. And then I was lucky enough to have an advisor who said, hey, Barney, you know, you should really focus into, you know, you should be doing what you're good at instead of trying other things. Like, why don't you give this a shot? And I remember being a junior and I thought, well, I could never complete this degree because I felt like I was all over the place. And I ended up staying in school one extra year just to finish my fine arts degree with, you know, a concentration in graphic design. And it was the best thing I ever did. I mean, I've worked as a designer my entire life. I've never done anything different besides those That's high school cool. jobs. I've never done anything different. And I feel like I've always been employed. And if not, I've always done freelance work. It's just something that it's always provided for me.
That's great.
And I've always had a passion to do it. So it never really felt like work.
Yeah, that's cool, man. And I really appreciate the fact that, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, as a person who is melanated, for lack of a better term, right? There's not a lot of designers. There's way more, and I'm seeing a lot more younger people get into it, like black and brown kids.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or black and brown young adults, I should say, because they're not really kids, but it's always nice to hear someone else's perspective about that. And the fact that you just had this passion for it, but you also had the outlet for it. And I had no idea what the outlet was growing up. I just drew. But it's nice to see that you're in that and you're always thinking of ways to progress. And it goes back to what Andy was saying about wanting to learn more. And I always love the phrase ABC. And it's like, you know, I'm not thinking about Alec Baldwin saying, you know, always be closing. I'm thinking about more like Ted Lasso. Always be curious. Always be searching for the reason why something's done, or trying to understand it more, especially when it's something you don't understand.
Right.
Because when you're open to being curious, you're open to learning, you're open to progressing. And I think that's how you stay fresh. That's how you stay vibrant. And that's how you stay current in regards to being a designer. You can't do the same old stagnant shit because then people just stop either looking at you and you stop growing.
You become irrelevant.
Absolutely.
Right.
100%.
Right. And every person who's in a profession of performance and visuals, I believe, always has to continue to grow in order to be better at it, right? Like, they always have to be thinking of what's next and observing what's next. So hearing you talk about, I've been doing this for a long time, you've really seen all the changes in yourself and also in the design world around you, and that's just fucking dope.
Appreciate it.
What were you going to say, Andy? Of course, man.
I wanted to go back, because I've, like Kirk has, followed Barney for a while on LinkedIn.
And you've been more active, which is really cool. I'm really happy to see that.
For sure. Yeah, no, for sure. Thank you.
But I wanted, you talk a lot about, and Kirk, you touched on this, Barney, you touched on this, but, and this is part of the focus of this podcast, is to bring more diverse voices into design. And, you know, I don't look like you guys, but I'm not, let's say.
I thought it was the feet.
Hey, Kirk, we almost watched The Jerk this past week.
Navid.
And it made me think of you.
Oh, so great.
And then we saw that it was rated R, and it was made in the 1970s. And I was like, wow, 1970s R must be like today, NC-17.
Right.
Ridiculously explicit.
Right. So quick side note to that.
We decided not to do that.
Yeah, quick side note to that. My family, and this has nothing to do with design, but it has to do with Maven Johnson, who is from The Jerk. And those of you who don't know The Jerk, the premise is Steve Martin is a white dude raised by a black family. And the first line of the fucking movie is Steve Martin saying, I was raised a poor black child. And that's all you need to know. It is so culturally inappropriate, but it is just so fucking
wildly
funny. It is funny, funny, funny. And so my family used to have people growing up with us, and we would house people. We'd have people stay with us. And one of our friends, his name was Ben, and Ben was white. So we called him Naven. And to this day, this is when I was young. Like, this is when I was like 8. I'm going to be 47 soon. To this day, 4 decades later, we still call him Naven. Like, Naven's coming to see us. And it's just funny because it makes sense.
Yeah. So I want to hear what you think about bringing more diverse voices into the design community. But from my perspective, because I don't have the viewpoint of you all, you two,
you people,
you people. Oh God. is that we try. So like a lot of the design podcasts out there, I think interview pretty much the same people, and it's the conference track people that are all, you know, the big names. They're all very talented, but the last thing we need to do is listen to those sort of just navel gazing, like portfolio reviews of all these folks. So that's my drive for this podcast and other places where I try to connect with people, is to try to connect with folks that aren't highlighted necessarily, whether they're junior designers or emerging designers or designers artists from different backgrounds.
Right.
Yeah. But how, you take a pretty academic, strategic view of bringing diverse voices into design. So how do you approach that and your journey to that, and just how do you see it moving forward?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. That's a very important question. I mean, I think for me, my journey started, for many, many years as a designer, I always felt like I had to be just head down, do my work, and just do great design. And that's going to get you through. That's going to get you promoted. That's going to get you the job you want, the career you wanted. And for the most part, it did. And I was very, very happy with my career. Once I became a manager and I started seeing some of like the underbelly of how things work and how companies are looking out for themselves. And I was lucky enough to inherit a very diverse creative team. I had a Japanese designer, I had Filipino designers, Mexican, white, just very diverse team. Some of my folks were in Canada, some were in Colombia, some were in Germany. So I felt like that was the kind of team that I always wanted, and I've never seen that prior to this particular role that I had. Prior to that, I was typically always the only person of color in the design team, sometimes the only person of color in all of marketing, and sometimes the only person of color like in the entire building. Like, I remember my very first job at a college, walking around this entire building and not finding anybody that was of color. There was one other Dominican lady that worked as a receptionist in like another building. And I remember when I found her, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not the only one. Right. And it was mostly like that my entire career. And I honestly never really thought about it. I just felt like I needed to do a good job. I needed to represent myself and, you know, people that look like me very well in this environment. Like, don't mess up. Right. But once I became a manager and I had this very diverse team, I felt like this is exactly what creative teams should be. A place where you have different cultures, different ideas, different thoughts. Even in age group, I had very young designers and I had someone that was much, much older. And when we had brainstorms and when we talked about ideas, it was so diverse. It was like, it was exactly what I wanted. And well, so fast forward, I left that company. And I look back and that team that I used to have is all white now. And I'm just like, wow, literally like in less than 5 years, it just went right back to what, you know, what that company probably wanted it to be. So that's when I decided, and it was around COVID time, I decided, well, let me start writing about my experience as a designer, because maybe if I talk about what I was doing or in my experience, maybe other designers of color would relate and or see themselves as designers, right? Because I feel like I felt like a lot of people of color don't see themselves as designers, either because they don't feel like maybe this field doesn't pay enough, and you know they feel like if they go to college they need to do something bigger, right? So in my mind, I'm like, if people see me, they can see themselves in this career. So that's when I started talking and writing and mentoring and having a lot of, during COVID, I mean, we were all home, so we had a lot of extra time. So I was having this one-on-one, you know, kind of coffee chats with designers, college students trying to go into the design industry. And I thought like, okay, this is something I can do. I can help designers of color come into the industry by either talking about my experience or telling them how to get to where I am right now. So that's why a lot of my writing is about that. So obviously ever since then, my writing has evolved. I feel like I do speak to all designers more so than I used to speak to that group specifically, because I feel like I can help everyone. However, the majority of the folks that either gravitate towards my writing and my content and that come to my mentoring are people of color, and I love that. I mean, when I find out that someone got a job or a promotion, or they use a technique that I gave them, or a piece of writing that I wrote really resonated with them and helped them to get through a moment, that really makes me happy.
That's
awesome.
Okay. Yeah, that's just fucking amazing. There's no other way to put it. I was sitting here jotting down things as you were talking, because I'm trying to remember, like, you know, like, what to say in response to everything. There's just too much shit to respond to. But the biggest thing that I took out of that was diversity makes you stronger.
Absolutely.
Because, like Andy was saying, you do have different thought processes with different people. And you were saying, you proved what he was saying. You know, you have this super diverse group. You're going to have super diverse collaboration. And that's the subjectiveness of art and design. But there's always solutions.
Right.
There's always more than one solution. And I want anybody who's listening to this right now, just pause it. Don't stop listening. Don't get distracted. But pause it and think of any large firms. Think of your Pearl Fisher, your Pentagrams, your whatever. Go on there and look at their board. And I guarantee you, whatever board you look at, this is how it's going to be broken down. White male, white woman, women of color or whatever, and then people of color, like black women, black men. That's exactly how it's going to be broken down. And I guarantee you, on a board of 15, there's probably one black man in there, probably four or five women. There's definitely going to be two or three Asian women out of those four or five women, and maybe a black woman. That's not me stereotyping. I've done this several places, and that's just here. If you go overseas, it's worse. All white people. Like, that's it. That's all you see. And you don't you don't get that sense of, I'm not going to say a safe space, because as much as we would like that, that's just not going to happen. I would say an accepted space.
Exactly.
Because when they want people to bring their authentic selves, they're going to be more authentic with people who don't judge, who actually listen, or people who look like them. So the fact that you managed all those different people, all those folks, meant they felt accepted with you and were able to present ideas and not feel, and feel like designers and feel like artists. And it's still hard for me sometimes to say, and I'll say this to people like I know, but I always say, like, I'm good at what I do. Then I realize when I see other people's shit, it's like, I'm really fucking good at what I do, but I don't have the apropos or leverage. I say leverage to use it, because I'm black. And that's not any type of thing I'm making up. It's truth. If I was a white, if I was Andy, not saying that Andy's not an amazing and incredible designer and I love him, but if I was Andy with my skill sets, I would be running a Fortune 50 design company, a creative company, like a Fortune 50 creative space, because I know my skill set. And it's like, because I have, there's things that I have that Andy doesn't. Like, I have lettering skills, and Andy says he's not a letterer, right? And he said that time and time again. So sorry to blow you up, Andy, but.
What, Kirky wouldn't, because it's too much stress. And it's not right.
See, and that's probably the reason why. But
you would, Kurt, you would be right here where I am, just cruising.
It's probably true. You know it's true, because you know me, and I just.
But no. But your point of, like, yes, yeah. I mean, like we talked with Chad Cheek, you know, about I mean, he's running a very successful design agency. Why, you know, but he definitely hit on those. Mm-hmm. His name is Chad Cheek. Do you know what color Chad Cheek is?
Right.
You know, like, you don't know when you get that email from the RFP. And you know, he touched on, you guys had that moment where you really talked about, and Barney, you touched on it too, where like you have to be better than everyone else. You everything has to be buttoned up.
Right.
You can't present anything wrong.
Yep.
You can't speak differently.
Yep.
I mean, all that stuff is, you know, like you said, like stuff that other skinned folks don't have to worry about.
And it's,
I wanted to pick y'all's brain. This just popped in my
head. Keep that thought, Andy. Keep that thought.
Okay. Go
for
it.
The one thing that Chad said that's always stuck with me is good design trumps all problems.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He said good design solves all problems. Like, that's it. If you have really good design, people tend to look at you differently. But it has to be consistent, or else, like you were saying also, Andy, people will look back and say, oh. But anyway, you had a thought. Sorry, Andy. Just came
through. I'm going away from my notes here, but it's something that popped in my head. So, Kirk, you touched on most design agencies in marketing, whatever, agencies are headed up by mainly white men, some white women. And that's today. So back in the day when these like monolith brands and advertising campaigns and all that kind of stuff was created that we've all turned into popular culture, those definitely were done art directed, creative directed mm-hmm. by white people. Okay. But somehow those things have become part of I'm talking about all of us mm-hmm. here, not just white America, but everyone here. It's become part of our pop culture and our identity. So do you think that, so square that with me, where like these people that supposedly were out of touch or not maybe like able to identify or have certain voices in the boardroom were able to create these campaigns that resonate with us. And then do you think that now that we're getting more and more diverse voices, are we going to see a shift in like creative advertising and like, what is that going to look like now that we don't have, you know, now that we have more interesting voices in the boardrooms or in the review boards, but let's go back to that past and how those, like, I mean, we all grew up. I mean, we all sort of look about mm-hmm. the same age, I think, you know, give or take a few years, but still like, and maybe this is totally my sort of like my blindness to it, because like, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not saying that like it was all hunky dory, but you know, I grew up in a certain like way with like McDonald's and all that kind of stuff. And I saw myself in those commercials. So, and maybe you didn't, Kirk, you know, and like, you were like, no, I never saw myself in this. But Madison Avenue designed something that we all identify with, and it became part of our popular culture, despite being all white men. But how do we, but was that all wrong, or how do we figure, I don't know, this maybe is a whole nother podcast, but I wanted to, just popped in my head because yeah, I think it could be interesting to see. There almost is like a you know, we could almost like draw a line between, you know, past design and advertising and future, post future, whatever you want to call it.
I do have to add that Dr. Cheryl D. Miller would probably slap me in the hand if I didn't say that, that, you know, there were a lot of people of color in the design industry that were in the shadows, right? So that they, you know, the perception was that they were not in the picture. And Cheryl D. Miller does a great job of explaining this, so I'm not going to go into it, but looking her up would be great. People of color, we've always been in design from the very beginning, mm-hmm. and we've always contributed to design, even though we've been in the shadows for many, many, many years. So I think that's another layer, I think, that we need
a great point.
Acknowledge that did happen. But you ask a great question. I don't know. I didn't see myself in a lot of the things I saw on TV. I mean, I hate to bring up the Cosby Show, but you know, that was one of the shows that you would watch and be like, okay, I see myself in this family. So yeah, I mean, we didn't see ourselves, but it was the only thing available. So you just kind of go with the flow, right? And it's not till you get to a point where you can make a difference that you start doing that.
That's great. Interesting.
It's no secret that, I'm trying to think the best way to say this, ideas have been stolen from people of color for generations, right? Like,
that's true.
And so for me, I don't even think that that's not even a possibility that would happen. But the other thing too is when you're able to control the narrative, and good marketing does this. Everything back then was good marketing. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you didn't have was real competition.
True.
Like,
yeah.
You had the TV, you had print, and you had radio spots. You didn't have social media. That's why companies like Midday Squares or Liquid Death or even like Ryan Reynolds' company, Maximum Effort. Granted, they have his star power, but they're also very clever, well done advertisements. Absolutely. And that's the thing. People will appreciate cleverness, but also at that time, there wasn't the competition either. Like, there wasn't any real, and I'm not saying like there weren't other firms.
That's so true. Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of different avenues of media to actually protrude your feed. Right. There was no feed. If you had a TV, you saw commercials. If you picked up a newspaper, you would see an ad. And if you had radio, you listened to the radio. You had three channels to see things.
Right.
Now you have one channel, your phone, right? But you have myriad options of how that information gets fed into it. And I think, too, that that's what created. If a company has the monopoly on what is advertised and what isn't advertised, like if I said, where's the beef? And you're old enough to remember that, you know it's from Wendy's, right? It's like there's certain phrasing and things that happened during that time and that really – you know, cornered or monopolized the market as far as what was trendy and what was cool. And I think that's a big, 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 big deal as far as like, and Andy, it's only going to get, and the fucked up thing is it's almost too much now. And I'm going to hear me out for this in a second. There's quote unquote TikTok challenges or things of nature. It's like people do one thing and then it becomes a meme or the other people do it. It's like, someone's always lopping on or piggybacking off something else that someone has said or done. And now it becomes more of a who got there first rather than who got there or who did it well.
Right.
Like, it's always like, oh, they're the first person to do this, which is great, but what, do they do it right? And who's to say if it's even right or wrong? It's just that it catches popularity and it becomes part of pop culture, becomes part of our everyday, like, influence, and that also influences design and everything else. So it's going to be a free for all, and I think I don't think anything will really stay on trend. I think this is just me. I think that companies are going to rebrand like maybe once a year.
They'll have to,
right? Like I really think that trends are going to be that quick to where like, oh, that brand is working. Let's try something else because people will demand it. Like, oh, it's old. I want something new.
Right.
But I think that's the thing. With our attention span being much shorter, being on our phones and talking, I think that's going to be something that's coming up.
And I also feel like when companies, just to add to your point, when companies make a mistake now, you know, they get attacked very quickly, right? Like, companies in the past could make mistakes or, you know, be insensitive and it was just okay, right? There was no way to complain. You still go to McDonald's and buy that burger, right? That you just don't have the choice. But you know, if McDonald's has a campaign now and it's insensitive to whoever, you know, because of the power of social media and because, you know, obviously things are different now, they would get very quickly would get attacked and they would very quickly would have to redo it. Apologize, everything. I mean, we see it happening all of the time.
Yeah.
Where companies are all coming out trying not to get canceled.
Yeah.
That's spot on. Here's the thing. I don't drink Starbucks because I think it's shit coffee, but how they treat their employees. I don't do In-N-Out because they're highly right wing. I don't do Chick-fil-A. And most recently, and this just kills me, is I stopped doing Taco Bell because they're also very anti-LGBT, QA plus. And I stopped eating Taco Bell. And that's really, it's silly. Amazon as well. I don't use Amazon. Like, if I watch a Prime show, and for those who are listening, I do not illegally download them and watch them, but I might know someone that does and whatever. But I don't use those on principle, but bottom line, does it matter? For me, it does, but not for everyone else. And when you call people out now, it will last for a little bit, but I think it goes through. Like, people stop forgetting, they forget about it and move on.
It cycles through pretty quick.
Yeah. So there may be some call out, but you're absolutely right. Like, that wouldn't even be touched back in the day. Like, it just would be blown up.
Yeah, over. I mean, I think at least now you have the option of knowing and the option of supporting. Right. And there have been many cases where companies, you know, have changed or done things differently because of pressure from, from, you know, this new audience that we have now. So, yeah, there's been a change for sure.
Yep.
Barney, I wanted to shift a little bit, and you talk a lot about employment and jobs and getting hired and that kind of stuff. And I was wondering, networking within design, like how do you approach that, or how do you consult, mentor people on approaching that in this sort of like hybrid world of like, do we go to conferences? Do we go to social, you know, mixers? Do I need to move to a whole nother city to become job worthy? You know, like, what? How do we do this now? Especially for emerging designers who are maybe just leaving college and trying to figure out their path.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my mentorship, when I talk about networking, which I do that, I think every single day I'm talking about that. For sure, even as young as, you know, high school graduates, I tell them, get on LinkedIn, right? I feel like LinkedIn is a great space. Obviously.
Yeah.
Overall.
Yes. I was going to say there are some issues there. I don't know if you saw my post lately, but I recently had my complaints recently about it.
It's crazy.
So, you know, there's good and bad things, but I think that if you're going to be on Instagram, which you can be, just posting and gaining followers, you might as well be on LinkedIn as well, making connections, meeting other Black designers or people in the industry. So I encourage young designers to find creative groups, engage in conversation, start communicating yourself, you know, whether you're adding color to someone else's post via comment, or you're writing something yourself. You should start, you know, talking about design, like really engulf yourself in the industry by following some of these channels, some of these creative groups. There's a lot of great creative groups. I love posting on them because you get all these opinions, and it becomes like sometimes like it just becomes like a world that the comments become a world. I've done blogs about comments. I'm like, because of this 10 cool. comments, let me write a piece about that, right? So I do encourage people to communicate, talk about the industry, put your opinions out there. I think that it's a great way to meet people. It's a great way to make connections, especially when you're young and coming out of college, or even in high school or coming out of high school. And also when you're a young professional, it's great to continue meeting new people. If there's a company that you like, follow that company. Make comments, share their content if you feel like it's something that resonates with you. In addition to LinkedIn, I think there's a lot of other groups on Slack, for example, which is something new to me. About a year ago, I started using Slack very heavily, and I realized that there were a lot of creative groups, whether in specific groups too. Like, there's UI UX groups if you like that. There's groups about branding. There's groups about people of color. where the Black Designers, one of the groups that I follow, that I feel like really got me introduced to like this world of Black and Brown designers that I wasn't part of. Tekeria, it's another great Slack group that it's more on the tech side, but it's like, you know, it's like a blend between taco and tech. So it's like Tekeria. And I love that, you know, there's so many people, Spanish people, Latin people there that are talking about design. They're talking about tech and they're introducing each other. Yeah. There are so many posts about like, hey, I applied at this company. Does anybody have a contact? And then someone else would be like, oh, that's my God, my friend works there. I'm going to introduce you. And I've seen connections like that happen all of the time. So I feel like there's a lot of power in networking, and especially now you have it. Like you said, you have it on your phone. You don't have to go anywhere to do it.
Yeah.
So you can network a lot
online.
Obviously, in person is great as well. So like joining your local AIGA groups or AAF groups, you know, those are great ways to network locally, but definitely online you can do it. And I feel like that eventually leads to a potential job, a potential career change, or even, you know, if you're really good at building or creating content, a brand might hit you up and say, hey, listen, can you write for us? I like your photography. Can you design design for me? I, you know, my bus design was someone that I partnered with that I met online. And I said, hey, I really like your art. Can we collaborate on this design together? So it does happen. It happens frequently. So that's why I definitely encourage folks to network online for sure.
Yeah, it's been... Awesome. Yeah, man, it's just being on with Andy and then seeing the engagement, even if they're quote unquote not directly engaging with us, but to see people listening to our podcast means that this is a form of networking for us. Granted, we have amazing guests on, the best guests in the world, and we have amazing conversations, but it's not guaranteed people will listen to them. Like, they're taking time out of their day to give up, you know, 30 to 45 minutes to listen to our podcast. And I think it's great. It's a great way to network. And speaking of time, we're coming up on it. And first of all, let me thank you so much for joining us today. It was our privilege. And if Andy has anything else to add, I would like to ask if you had anything else to add.
For me? Or Andy?
Let me just jump in and say that I don't have anything else to add. I do have other questions, but it's too much for this conversation. But Barney, once a podcast guest, always.
Oh my God! Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
We will bring you back for part one, part two, part three, part four.
Please do. I would love to come again.
So this is just
scratching the surface.
We just scratched the surface.
As long as
go ahead.
Yeah, Barney. I think the one thing that I wanted to add. Is that in addition, you know, I do talk about diversity in design. I do talk about the design industry and networking and through my mentorship, which is something that I do through ADP List. So ADP List is a great free mentorship for just about anyone. So I encourage folks to, you know, even if you're not struggling in your career, it's great to have a mentor, someone that you can bounce ideas off. You can share your portfolio or ask questions. It's always good to have that. So I love providing that service for free. But I also talk a lot about mental health. And one thing that I wanted to add is that, and it's that I feel like designers, we have the perception of being kind of happy-go-lucky folks. You know, we're just sharing memes and making jokes all day long. And I write a lot about the fact that designers experience stress just as much as other industries. You know, what we do, it's, you know, when we design, we're putting our ideas, our thoughts, our feelings into paper or into the computer. Even if you're designing for a company or a product, it is still your thoughts and your ideas that, you know, makes that product come to life. So
it's an emotional absolutely experience.
And we're highly criticized. I mean, if you think about it, we're like one of the only industries that our work is criticized along the way. It's like, as you're designing, you're being criticized and you're being told, go back and do it again or do it this way. And sometimes you have to swallow it and do something different. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes your best idea goes into that folder that never sees the light of day. So I feel like understanding that designers get as stressed and experience mental health issues just as much as other professionals. My wife and I have a workshop that we provide again through ADP List. We do it once a month. It's for free. It's about...
Wait, hold up. You're married?
So I'm married, yes. And my wife...
Oh, man, we got to have your wife on.
She would love to. She...
Hell yeah.
She's actually, if I move the camera, you can
I interrupted, man. I'm sorry. Your wife and I, once a month, you do a thing.
So, yeah, she's a marriage and family therapist. So we partner where I talk about design and she talks about mental health. And our audience is specific, or workshop specific to designers. So we do that once a month. That's and great. It's free, but it's a way to like bring designers in, talk about mental health, talk about tips and tools that they can use to like relieve stress, to not, you know, to find ways to take criticism better. So that's mm-hmm. the only other thing that I wanted to mention is that, you know, mental health is a big part of what I do.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
Thank you,
Barney. You guys are going to take over the world. Thank you, Barney, so much. Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
I appreciate being here today.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, man. So hold on. We're going to do a quick close and we're going to say bye for real. All right, I'm Kirk Vaisol. I'm the founder and creative director of Mind the Font, and I'm here with my good friend,
Andy Kurtz, founder and creative director of Buttermilk Creative.
And you just listened to the Kirk and Kurtz Design Podcast with our very special, amazingly awesome, stupendous, and cool-ass guest, Mr. Barney Abramson. And we all talk to y'all next time. Peace.
Bye.
All right, we're done. Dude,
that was so great.
Fucking spectacular.
Thank you, Barney. You guys are awesome.
That was spectacular.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Kirk and Kurtz Design Podcast. A very special thanks to our guest, Barney Abramson. You can find out more about Barney in the podcast description. Peace.